Hello and welcome to Joe Talks Comics. This is the podcast where I talk with friends about the comics that we've been reading and enjoying lately, plus occasional solo episodes and creator interviews. This week, me and Mighty D's Comics were lucky enough to sit down with Rob Williams and Pi Parr, the creative team behind the new Image Comics book, Petrolhead. This is an awesome comic that we both fell in love with, started in November last year, 2023. And then the first arc concluded in March 2024. So last month, if you're listening to this, in April when it comes out. The trade is out in June, currently saying June 4th. So make sure to go order it with your local comic book shop or order it your local bookshop or wherever you get your trades. But obviously, try and please support local comic shops if you can. But yeah, this is a really cool comic that I know we were both really recommend, and this was a really fun conversation that we got to have. Mighty D can join me on the intro, but they'll be joining me soon along with Rob and Pi. And before we get into the episode, I wanted to give you a rundown of the synopsis. The Iron Giant meets Mad Max Fury Road in this pedal to the metal action-packed sci-fi series. In a climate crisis ravaged future metropolis, an old, grumpy, obsolete, smoke-belching, car-jumping, hot-rod, bracing robot is one 12-year-old girl's only hope. Together, can they outrace the chasing Robocops with an invention that might just save humanity? So, a point that Mighty brings up in this conversation is how it sounds, I mean, it can sound very sort of car-focused and high-octane action, action-packed, but there's such a strong emotional core here, which I also want to stress as well. There's so much depth and excitement to this with the characters, the emotional stakes, the world building, the robots and cars themselves. I mean, we mentioned many, many times how much we adore Pi's art, and Rob mentions that as well. And it's just one of the most special and exciting comic books that we've come across in recent months, as we discovered it back in January. And especially when it comes to like indie comics, I think it's really exciting when there is something this unique and fully formed, seemingly, that comes out from Image, something which needs and deserves your support if it is to continue, if we are to get future volumes, which I really hope so. So yeah, I don't think I have anything else to say. So without further ado, I'll let you get into the conversation. I hope you enjoy, and as always, I'll see you on the other side. So, Rob and Pi, welcome to the podcast. We're very excited to have you here. As Mighty said briefly before we started recording, it's a comic that we both fell in love with as soon as we finally started reading and catching up on it a few months ago. So, yeah, we're excited to chat.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for being so sort of supportive throughout, really. Charlotte, my wife, runs our social media, and she's always sort of saying, oh, no, Joe's, you know, sharing everything and loving it and just interacting a lot. And it's very appreciated.
Yeah, that's so cool. It's always, it comes up, especially when I've done a lot of like Kickstarter conversations about indie comics and things. And inevitably, social media always tends to come up as part of those conversations. So I think it's not to be underestimated these days just how vital a role people can have in it, which is really cool on both ends.
Especially sort of, I find it quite a time sink, to be honest, especially sort of emotion, well, like an emotional sort of sink as well. It's quite,
right,
I find it quite hard to do myself, and it's quite nice that she took it on, because otherwise we'd just be awkwardly posting random crap every time we had 10 minutes.
No, totally.
Instead of like planning it out properly, you know, I had all these like highfalutin ideas about what we were going to do with all the social media, and then I just ended up getting behind on the deadlines, drawing all the time, and just passing it, giving it to someone else.
Yeah, so, and I'm officially useless at that stuff, so it's I'm a complete luddite with it. So it, yeah, thank God we've got someone vaguely professional helping.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I mean, that's the really cool thing early on was like just discovering that social media presence, because I think maybe apart from Night, the comic, another Image comic that we love, I can't think of any other comic book that has its own like dedicated Instagram account. I mean, obviously like writers and artists and the people like plug it on their social medias, but it is quite cool if you have the resources to be able to put something like that out there.
Definitely. that's how I realized that the book was worth checking out. Even like I saw the initial cover, I was like, that art style is amazing, but I saw a car and I was like, that probably won't be particularly for me. So whenever I got around to reading it and seeing that there's well more than wheels to this book, I was just immediately sucked in. But yeah, I don't think I can think of others that have a dedicated social media page, and that presence is what really got me onto this book.
Oh, that's interesting, and also good to know, really, because it gives you something to hide behind, because you're, rather than talking about something you've done, it's like you can speak as the comic, and
Exactly.
But it is, I've been doing this a long time, and you know, when you have something like Petrolhead, which we genuinely felt, you know, really excited and enthused about, and we love, and how you get it into people's hands, and how you get comic shops to take a chance on kind of not ordering one copy, you know, because comic shops totally understandably don't want to go out and order 20 of a new book just in case they get stung. And, you know, it's far safer for them to go out and order a bunch of Batman comics or something like that, you know. So how you actually, you can have the best comic in the world, and how you actually get people to take a chance on it and buy it is a challenge, and one which we're constantly trying to work out. Still how to do, to be honest.
I think that presence in the marketing of the comic really works in your favor, because otherwise you really are working on word of mouth in shops and outside of shops. And, you know, being in shop myself, working and seeing how little people that typically come in for comics realize about the pre-ordering process and the FOC and all that. A lot of folks don't see the book until it's on stand. So they ask what it's about. And we're like, you know, we're looking up solicitations on hand if it's been a month since we ordered it, kind of thing. So having that constant reminder of like, okay, there's this book that's coming out and I need to keep an eye out on it. And, you know, there's also this, you know, brevity to those posts. I think your wife really nailed in keeping it in touch with the tune of the actual story, which I felt was a nice touch of character on my feed every time y'all pop up.
Sure. Oh, good. Yeah, I'll tell her that. She's sort of, she gets quite excited about doing it, really.
That's so sweet.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting you say about the, I think it's difficult, isn't it, in the age of Amazon, where you can just click on something and have it the next day.
Yep.
That it's quite a lot. It's a difficult ask to make people go into a shop twice, you know, once to pre-order and then another time to go and pick it up. And I think that's quite difficult, especially like in this country. I mean, it's like an hour's drive to my nearest comic shop. It's not like something I'm just calling out.
But saying all that, it's still a lot easier to do that than it is to order a comic digitally, which God bless the comics industry for making the digital comic buying process the most convoluted, difficult thing you can
do. Really? I've honestly never tried.
Oh, man, the whole Comixology, and then Comixology morphed into, now you have to read it through your Kindle. I literally have gone to buy a couple of comics digitally and gone and given up and gone, this is just too difficult. So only comics could make it that difficult to recommend.
No kidding.
Well, yeah, because that's the whole thing, where now that it's Comixology is integrated into Kindle, it's bad enough. But then Amazon, in an effort to scrounge as much money as they can away from Apple and Android, I think that's why they disabled in-app purchases on their apps. So you have to go onto the website. So if you want to read it on your tablet or iPad or whatever, you have to then buy it on the website on a browser and then read it on your tablet in a weird app. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Why make it easy for people to buy? But I mean, I guess God bless them for doing that, because at least that protects comic stores. So, you know, which we all want to do. It's so self-harming. You know, it's just like, anyway. But yeah, I could rant about this for.
I know, well, that's not the thing that always people say as well. There's like the price of digital comics, and the effort to sort of make them just as expensive as physical comics. I mean, obviously, I suppose that that's just like the effort to make as much money as possible. But it's also the interesting idea that if for some reason, like, they were owned by something that wasn't worried about making money, they could just undercut physical comics. But anyway, it's a whole conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as we discovered, like, print costs are a major part of your sort of cost when you're doing something like this. So, and obviously there's none of that's involved. There's like, you literally press a button, it's on there. So I think it is a bit cheeky, because you could half the price probably.
I see people that get really, really up in arms about digital pricing too. So it's fascinating to look at it and to hear from creators too, to say, okay, how is this? Because, you know, my most recent experience getting something digital comic-wise was actually through a Kickstarter who's got, I think, $10 physical copies and $1 PDFs. And wow. I was like, really, $1? And that was like a Canadian dollar, so I only had to pay like change for it. And I was like, you think, you know, people would pay more for that? You know, I think a typical Kickstarter would have a PDF for a few bucks even. But, you know, that creator's like, I don't need to. I can get my cost the rest of the way, and then, you know, whoever reads it digitally just helps me boost the numbers up a bit. And it's interesting to see that because you don't want to have, like you said, to completely undercut the local comic shops because that's what keeps this industry alive. That's where the word of mouth happens. Mm. Nobody talks to you whenever you go to Amazon's website except for 1,000 ads, and they're, you know, very curated, not exactly to your taste either. So there's nowhere to buy comics quite like an actual comic shop. And, you know, bless Comixology for screwing that up. So it really does still work out for them. I know my boss really is like, yes, piss off to that system. But, you know, back on topic with Petrolhead, figured now's a good time to have y'all introduce the book, kind of give us a rundown of what this is for folks who didn't get a chance to read it yet. Tell them what they are going to be picking up if they pre-order the trade.
Basically, it's in a dystopian future. The environment has collapsed and the last remaining human beings live in 7 domed cities. And in order to stop people going insane, the remaining humans, the overseers of the city basically created future sports. And one of them was the Petrolheads, which was drag racing robots, basically. And they've all these robots have got their own personalities, and they've been designed by marketing teams to fit demographics. They have toys. And they were given, these robots were given feeling chips, basically, to allow them. So when they smash into each other and blow up and everything, there's more drama about it. So that was the Petrolheads. But then after a while, someone worked out that having petrol belching robots in a domed city where the environment outside had died was a really bad idea. So they shut the Petrolheads down. So when our story starts, we meet a scientist and his daughter, and she's called Looper, and they're on the run because her father thinks that he's come up with a way to put the climate right, to sort of save the planet. But there's a robot overseer of a city called the O, and he won't allow that because he has been, well, for reasons you'll see, basically. He's our big bad. So Lupa and her father end up hiding out in a garage in the crappiest part of the city called the Smog Zone, and it just happens to be Petrolhead's garage. And when the Robocops turn up and start getting heavy, and Petrolhead is kind of like, at this point, he's like the old retired heavyweight boxer. He's not going back in the ring. He won't drive anymore. He's giving it all up. And then basically he's forced to go on the run and do what he does best, which is get in the car, the big sort of hot rod that he's designed. And from that point on, it's a race across the city to try and get Looper and her father and this invention of his and try and see if they can get it out of the city. But the O is determined to stop him. So, it's just a lot of fun, and it looks absolutely amazing because of Pai's designs and Pai's colors. And it's just a really, if it sounds like a heavy science fiction book, that's in there in a way in terms of the themes. But really, we wanted to have a really fun, high-paced, thrilling kind of comic, which felt a bit like a Pixar movie on the page. Hope.
That's very interesting to hear you say that, Pixar on the page, because there is this like underlying satirical nature to this book in the way we're looking at sports, entertainment, and the, you know, pollution as is, and, you know, combining the two with these Petrolheads. But under that guise of it is softer, like a Pixar book, while still being, you know, it's a cheeky book. You know, I don't think there's a single issue in this first volume that didn't have me cackling on the couch and then stopping to reread it out loud to my fiance. Genuinely, so much funny stuff in this book that you almost forget how dire the circumstances are, that this is, you know, world-saving device that's supposed to save everybody in these domes. And one of the first things you all did in setting the stage for this book, you know, through introducing what the Petrolheads were, you set this character up as so devoid of love from anyone on the outside that they didn't even bother to give him a cool, flashy name. He just is Petrolhead. Yeah. And that struck me immediately. And I think it goes right to what you said, Rob, about he's this, you know, this heavyweight champ who's he's not getting in the ring anymore. But even in his days in the ring, he wasn't really seen for his value. And I think that's a great way to set up this character.
Yeah, I think he's the underdog. I mean, basically, is what we were trying to achieve. But he's very much, he's kind of like, in terms of an archetype, he's, you know, he's Ben Grimm in The Thing, in The Fantastic Four. He's, I don't know, if he was a human being actor, I always thought him like Ernest Borgnine, if you remember the old actor Ernest Borgnine. I always sort of thought he's basically there's a lot flashier models out there of the petrol heads, as we see. And like I said, as you pointed out, you know, the marketing teams gave them all cool looks and cool designs. And he was a kind of made from throwaway parts. And he never sort of, he's not the one winning the bulk of the races, as you see in the flashback in issue one. You know, if he gets on the podium, it's an amazing result for him in the heyday of the petrol heads. But I think it's very telling. You learn more about him as you go, as we progress through the book. And you can kind of see his, even in, he makes his, he's got a friend who's a robot bird called Dave. Dave is effectively like his sarcastic conscience. He's like Jiminy Cricket in a way. And Petrolhead made him in his garage. But just the fact that he made such a pretty thing as his conscience, I think is very telling, you know? I mean, basically, when they made these robots, this race of robots, they kind of inadvertently gave them all souls. So as the story progresses, while initially you see Petrolhead as a real big, terrifying bruiser, you kind of see there's a lot more to him once you start sort of, once we go on this journey. And that was one of the lovely things about it, you know. And as you said, I think what we're trying to do in the book, and I think we've succeeded quite really well, is there are underlying themes which are quite dark and heavy sci-fi, but we've given it quite a sweet, fun, thrilling kind of like that. The taste of the book, it's like a spoonful of sugar makes medicine go down, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's a very breezy book. As we've sort of alluded to, it's like thrilling and exciting, and the artwork having that very cartoonish animated flair. But yeah, there are some darker and more serious themes and ideas here and characters, and it's got a lot of emotional heart to it, for sure. Heart.
But I think that's one of my favourite things, really. When you're reading it, you'll kind of get, you know, sort of the story will build to a sort of fairly dark bit and then immediately punctured by like a funny line. And I love that because it just sort of takes the edge off the seriousness.
But I think it's quite, I mean, one of the great selling points of the book and one of the great strengths of the book is Pye's colours. And just the fact, even if we've got dark themes, you know, and the underlying sort of like climate collapse and, you know, AI, the fear of AI and all these kind of things are in there. But when you open the book, what you see is the sort of, you know, Pye's colours will knock you over. You know, it's a bright, you know, it's a really sort of beautiful to look at, bright looking book. It's not a dark, turgid kind of, well, you know, and like you say, the pace of it with the fact that we, you know, effectively it's a road movie and it's a chase movie on the page. Yeah, and it's high paced. You know, it had to be. This is a story about a racing robot. You know, we didn't want to kind of. It's meant to be sort of. You know, you're reading it and sort of. You know, it's a pacey read as well. But hopefully, we're getting a lot of depth in there as well. So you're getting bang for your buck, I would hope.
Well, even on this first page that Pye has, this illustration of Petrolhead smoking a cigar and he's got Dave on his shoulder looking. Watching his back while he holds this mechanical rose, I think it is, and this clear like in memoriam graffiti on this wall right before getting heckled by authorities. And it does immediately establish that, hey, this dude is a huge, bulky presence. He might look kind of rusty from this first page, but there's an immediate softness in seeing him in this act of you know, honoring a lost friend, or you know, whoever this may have been to him before we realize anything. And then Dave chimes in, and he, like you said, he's this sarcastic, you know, this Jiminy Cricket, I think, is a hilarious call for him, because I hadn't actually thought of him like that. But he's like the Johnny Blaze to Petrolhead's Ben Grimm to me.
Yeah.
I feel that pretty wholeheartedly. And what's funny, because I know, I think, Rob, you work on the Dread comics, and I've never actually read any comics, but I've seen, you know, Carl Urban's Dread. That's the other character that comes to mind with Petrolhead, is Carl Urban's depiction of Judge Dread and Ben Grimm. I think that's where I see this guy. And no, you know, if I had seen this first page, I would have absolutely ordered this immediately. Just immediately taken by the emotion, and you can't even see but a fraction of his face.
Yeah, it's body language there, which I think Pai did like really well. And one of the hard things, I mean, Pai should talk about this, not me, but one of the hard things, I guess, about doing this book is if you have a large part of your cast, not all of them, there's humans in it, but are robots, but just body language, you know, and selling their humanity and how they're feeling and their emotions. Because traditionally we're taught that, like, robot stories, they'll be, what is this thing you call love? You know what I mean? But it's, but with these guys, you know, they are they might be robots, but they're effectively, so, like, say, they have souls, they have feelings.
Yeah, I always assume just treat them like humans. It's not even a question. They're just people like anyone else when I sort of do them.
There's genuine times in this story where I forget that there's not a person inside that's just moving around in this Petrolhead suit, like, genuinely. So when it comes back to me that they are not technically people, but, like, these robots, it blows my mind just how emotional you've been able to make these characters, especially one that is, like we said, you know, he's kind of scrappy parts. He's not as visually expressive as some of the later racers we end up meeting, who have full on, you know, emotions displayed on their face, like those rave masks or like a Daft Punk helmet kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where there's full emotions being conveyed by, you know, eyes and mouth, everything. Whereas Petrolhead is just this stone face, and to make a robot feel so emotional with just an image, not a single sentiment statement shared, I think that's incredibly powerful way to start this book off before jumping into, like you said, once it gets going, it really does. It has a couple of the flashbacks here and there, but for the most part, it is this fast-paced action story that doesn't really take a lot of time to dwell on the darker themes, which I think is what keeps it really, really accessible. And I think that's what you want to do when you're taking on those darker themes, because there's a thousand ways to tackle climate collapse. And, you know, if you want to scare the hell out of people, sure, that could work. But sometimes humor is the better way to go about it. You know, you're laughing at the buffoonery of, hey, we needed to entertain people in these domes because we polluted the entire world. What if we had machines putting out petrol fumes like crazy until we have to shut it down? Like, it's stuff like that where I personally find the humor side of it working better to me than some would call it, you know, fear mongering of sorts. I think it's a very effective way to get your point across without having to hammer it home necessarily. It just kind of, it's there, it's lingering. People know it's there. And I'm sure that by the end, the nail's all the way down, but it doesn't seem to rush the bigger themes as much as it focuses on just the story at hand and, you know, what otherwise is, I would say, is a mission almost.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, basically, we want you to really fall in love with these characters and go on a journey with them. And everything else is kind of like, it adds depth and hopefully, like, you know, that all adds to sort of the end result of what people take from the book. And I thought it was interesting in issue one, a lot of the reviews talked so heavily about the world building, you know, and I think, and that's great. And that's all there and in there. But I think I shouldn't speak for Pai, I think, but I get more of a kick out of like, a page, like when we get the characters like Hybrid later on, I was laughing out loud, you know, when the pages were coming through, and sort of, I think that's what gives us more of a kick. Is just we fell in love with these characters, and we just thoroughly enjoyed spending time with these characters, and we ended up with the cast broadens out as we go, and by the end we've ended up with like a weird little team book because. Because every time we introduced a new character, we just fell in love with them so much. We just wanted to keep them around. And I, you know, that's a kind of, I, with any kind of comic, that's the challenge. If you're writing pages and you're kind of, it's a bit of a slog, it'll probably be a little bit of a slog to read. But if you're just kind of having a blast when you're making this stuff, I think it translates to the reader, I hope.
Yeah, that's right. It's very gratifying to hear when you're saying you're sort of sat on your settee cackling to yourself, because that was the experience of working on it, really. I'd read some of the stuff in the script and be laughing about it, you know, texting Rob, like, this is a good line. And then he came back and said, you know, like, I've drawn it, and he's cackling at the pictures, and that's just a really lovely way to work.
Funny dialogue I find quite easy to write. I think what's hard, and what hopefully we've done here, is when it's all derived from character, it's all true to character, and when we get to the point where they're hybrid, and, you know, I think one of my favorite scenes is when they go and knock on Hybrid's door in his. He's another petrol head who's retired, and they have to track him down. And he comes out in an apron, and he's been baking robo cookies. And it's just, like you going into the inner life of these robots. It's just when they had a purpose, they were told, you are going to be racing drivers. And then they took that away. And it's like, well, what do robots do? Well, petrol head went off to his garage, and he built his own car, and he sulked, yes, and made Dave, because he didn't have a friend, which is very telling, I think, you know, Petrolhead. I think he's quite a lonely character, which is why he made himself a friend. And they go and find Hybrid, who is this narcissistic sort of superstar racing driver, and he's living in a junkyard, and he's perfecting his baking technique, which still makes me laugh.
The image is burned in my head as you tell
about it. My favorite line from that is the issue after, when he's like... when Supercar Stance turns up, and he says, "Oh, she haunts my robo dreams," which I think
yes.
ridiculous line, and I loved it.
His fear of her throughout that entire interaction was just so freaking hilarious.
But he does, when he's ranting in that, there is where he lets out his true feelings, where he says, "She's better than me. I can't beat her. She's strangely attractive. I can't beat her."
Yes.
Like, pull her back up there. She's strangely attractive. What? Ain't what? What?
And like you said, I think that everything that is very, you know, humorous in this book, it's true to character. You know, none of these characters are a complete buffoon. Even a Hybrid, as goofy and silly as he is, there's heart to that character beyond just silly robot that says silly things and is in an apron. Like, there's depth to this character of, like you said, you know, this guy had a purpose, and his sole purpose was he'd be the best at that. Naturally, he's programmed to be a narcissist. This is how a narcissist deals with being told, hey, that thing that you said it yourself, we made you for, you're done with. Bye. We're taking that away from you.
I think that's an amazing thing with him. It's just like you said, he was programmed to be a narcissist. So he's a narcissist. And then you leave him alone and take away his raison d'etre and his reason for being. I mean, like Dave says to him, he goes, "Well, those are amazing robo cookies. How do you get them to rise like that?" He goes, "None of your business."
No, I like the fact he almost starts to explain, like, "Thanks." Oh, no, no.
But it's like he's finding weird, esoteric, hidden depths. You know what I mean? Which I presume all the petrol heads who survived have to do. Maybe we'll meet more of them along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So far, you haven't introduced a single bad character, so I'm eager for whoever joins in next volume.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, I was like flicking through your website and like the issues and things as you're all talking and listening, and I had to bring up Satnav Sid, because I just came across him, and I was like, oh yeah, I have to mention. That was one of, like, you want to talk about like funny characters and things when we're like first reading the second issue, and then he pops up, and he was one of those things that me and Mighty had to like talk to each other about, and like sharing like dialogue and things, because it's just the whole like idea of this like AI Satnav thing that's somehow got a Cockney accent is just, yeah, another thing that's just brilliant, the humor of it.
Yeah, he's an example of, that's a very, wasn't in the pitch, wasn't in the plot breakdown. I get to, you know, we're working on issue 2, and it was like, right, they need a sat nav voice And I just thought there and then it'll be funny. It would be funny if it was a Cockney character. I don't know why I thought that.
Because it is funny.
But then what I love about that again is it, in terms of how it digs down the character, there's a really easy to miss it, which I really like, throwaway line where Looper says, "I can't understand what he's saying," and Dave says he's a Cockney, and Looper says, "What's a Cockney?" Because she's born in a future city, Dome City. I have no idea, and she says, "Oh." Dave says, "Oh, Petrolhead was watching this really old film and he wouldn't stop talking about it." Anyway, never mind. So it's like Petrolhead is watching really old films with Cockneys in them is just like a really weird idea for a lonely racing robot sitting in his garage.
Well, and it's even funnier because it even specifies like there was this one guy that was really funny and wouldn't stop talking about it. Just like laughing at this dude's voice and thinking of I wish I had a particular reference for an old movie that would fit the part, but just, you know, to me, it rings true to the idea growing up of being like, oh yeah, what if Samuel L. Jackson was really like snakes on a plane directing you via your GPS?
Yeah.
It takes that idea and gives it this fresh life of, you know, the fact that he wasn't initially in it, it blows my mind, especially seeing him on all the damn letter pages. And
yeah,
I don't know if there's been a funnier character introduced into comics this year than Sid. Every last bit of him cracks me up. That's usually how Joe and I keep up of who's read the latest issue as it was coming out, which one of us sent Sid's screenshots first. And we got
that's great to hear. And I mean, again, it's like he wasn't planned, but the moment he appeared on the page, it was like, well, he has to just be a recurring character. He just has to. And Pi and I have already talked about it. He's got his own plot. He's got his own little plot thread in the second arc.
Yes.
We have more plans for Sat-Nav Sid. But again, it's like it feels like sometimes you introduce characters and you go, oh, they're all right, but it doesn't quite work. And for whatever reason with Petrolhead, it felt like every new character we introduced was just like was popping and just sort of almost like demanding to carry on being in the book. Which is a good sign, really. But again, like, you know, Pi draws him amazingly. Consider he's quite limited in how he looks. He's effectively like a tennis ball with eyes and a mouth.
Yes. An emoji in his body. Yeah.
Yeah, but when he kind of gets, there's one point when he's hacking into the city mainframe and he says, "Oh, I'll have a gander," and he's just having a think about it. And I think it's pretty amazing the way Pi gets. Even Sat-Nav Sid's emotions are coming through. Yeah,
no, it's interesting you say about the letters page as well, because that's just sort of something that sprang out of his character. In that, like, if we want to have a way to talk to the readers, it doesn't seem right to have Petrolhead doing it. Like, he wouldn't be interested, and he suggested himself. And then, obviously, as soon as I can't remember who came up with the pun for Sid's soapbox instead of Stan's soapbox, but
I think it might have been you. I forget, but it's like what I will say about that letters page is it's a really hard work to write because you sort of go, "Oh, that'll be fun." And then you go, "Oh my God, futuristic Cockney slang is really, really difficult to write."
It's a mind bending, words. You know, what?
So you kind of sit down and you go, "Oh, what you think will be a fun idea is like me going, what the hell? How am I supposed to write this?"
And that's funny because it's like, even for like us, like here in England, I feel like it's still like an extra step to properly like work out what they're saying and like what's going on. So I'm sort of interested to hear like Mighty's sort of experience. Like, I can't imagine even like if you're more and more detached from like England as a country to try and like. It's certainly honourable.
Frame of reference. There's no pride in my reference or in my Cockney impressions. strictly shame and sorrow.
Yeah, I remember seeing like a review or something. Somebody saying, "Oh, I love the fact there's a Cockney bird in it." And I'm like, "No, you've not seen Cockney yet."
Yes, exactly. It's also the Sat-Nav Sid's reference point. So just like his rhyming slang is really weird. And at one point, he says, "Trousers made of clay, map doesn't say." And you go, "What? Trousers made of clay?" Like, so his entire patter is like that, which is really funny. But also, it did make me wonder whether or not anyone was going to have a single clue what he was talking about.
Even if I don't have a clue what he's saying, it still brings me such joy to read it in my head and to hear him in my head. Like I said, trying to write into the letters page alone, pretending with that Cockney accent, I was like, I have to give up partway through. I'm not going to embarrass myself any further, but I can't fathom responding to all the letters like that. It would definitely get taxing.
It's a mind bend, but he also, I mean, I think with the third, you kind of put the call out and you go, like, we'll do, in the first issue, I think we said, look, if we get enough responses, we'll publish them. But we didn't know, will we get any? I think we got like 53 or something. That's good.
Long live the letter page.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about the bots, but we haven't really gotten too much about Lupa. And I think that it would be a shame if we talked anymore without talking about how sweet of a young woman you've introduced to this harsh world of smog and death racing, essentially. The way she plays into this story and kind of showing that softer side of Petrolhead.
Well, not to start with as well, that's one of the sort of what I like is that they're quite antagonistic to start. He's clearly irritated with her for just inconveniencing him to start with. I think that's you can tell as soon as you start reading it, I hope that they're going to end up as friends and help each other out and change each other, but certainly not to start with, and I like that.
Antagonization at the beginning, it really works well. She's in the garage, like, you've got to help me. He's like, you just bounced into my garage. What do you mean I have to help you? No, like, it plays well in getting that redemption between them, of where over time they really come together, because before too long, Petrolhead doesn't have much of a choice whether or not he's involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, from the moment, basically, he punches a RoboCop. But I like the fact that in that first issue, his initial reaction, because he is just an old he's an old grump, and I can relate because I'm an old grump, he gives her up. He basically, walks into his garage, and she rather plaintively puts her finger to a lip and goes, shh, please don't tell on us, effectively. And he just takes a look and he walks out and tells the RoboCops, two humans in my garage. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He's not a hero. He's effectively Han Solo in Star Wars. He's going to come good, but he's going to be really grumpy along the way. But then when the RoboCop slaps Looper, it's a great panel. I love how Pye drew it. They both, as one, go, hey, and that's like, there's a line crossed now, you know what I mean? And from that point on, they're forced together by circumstance but even then, in issue two, there's some good quality. When they're arguing, they're driving away from all the chasing RoboCops and sort of the drones, it is effectively Han Solo in Empire Strikes Back, basically, in the Millennium Falcon, and, bickering, and telling him, don't tell me what to do. But along the way, they just kind of, and Dave, Dave, like I say, Dave is effectively Jiminy Cricket to Petrolhead. He's his conscience. And I think Dave sort of makes him help Looper. But kind of Petrolhead wanted to.
It's interesting trying to get that right, isn't it? Because I remember in like issue two, there's a bit where he comes out and says your dad's going to be okay. And I think in the original script, I'd had him putting his hand on her shoulder or her hugging him on, and it was like, no, too soon. They're not close enough. You've got to balance this quite right to make it feel right.
Yeah. It's got to be it's got to be kind of earned, hasn't it? And I think by the end of the first arc, they're a little team. They're on the run together, they're helping each other out, without giving a spoiler away, there's Looper does something in issue five and Petrolhead shouts in concern, for her, born out of it's what they've been through together and what they, the challenges they're trying to overcome together, rather than, a bad version of it would be them sitting down and telling each other stories about their past. It's a high paced chase book. And
they're just very naturally together. Yeah. And, I'll go right to the part you're talking about where, he wakes her up to let her know that Doc says her dad's going to make it. Even in the shot, like right after it shows she's crying and thanking him, he says, "You're welcome, kid," as he'd already lit up a cigar and is literally blowing a ring of smoke.
Yeah.
There's still that disconnect of like, yeah, you know, okay, I'm helping you out, but don't get too attached kind of feel. Very much like you're saying, Han Solo. I hadn't really put that in my mind until you mentioned it, but he does have that reluctant hero kind of vibe.
Yeah, and as you said, it's interesting, actually. I hadn't thought about it when you said about the Carl Urban Dredd film. He is that. You know, one thing Dredd is like stoic, you know, taciturn, a man of few words. And that's exactly what Petrolhead is. He's kind of, and that's the way he's been programmed. He's not, you know, but a lot of his actions show that there's more of an inner life there than you will ever get words out of his mouth. You know what I mean? He's a grumpy, like old heavyweight racing car driver.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's always exciting to hear, which I think is reflected in the comic, is the sort of that, not just like the depth and the layers to it, but how it just all comes together really nicely. Like you mentioned earlier about people mentioning like the world building and how much you enjoy like the humor, and talked about like Petrolhead himself and Looper and sort of different kinds of characters. And I do think like genuinely that something that struck me so early on is how much of a complete package it all feels, which I think is really special when those sorts of comics come along that like sort of particularly feel special in that way, like everything from like the actual comic itself with all the different elements, the emotional elements, the world building and like the design work and all of that, the extra stuff with the letters and the social media and all of that. It just all feels like it meshes together and melts together really nicely.
I don't know, it just kind of happened, didn't it, really?
But it also, I mean, what I would say is part of the reason I think it feels so fully formed is basically A, there's only two of us involved. And also Pi, I write the script, but Pi does everything else. I mean, Pi's wife does the social media as well, so even that's a kind of par kind of but it's like, but I mean, the designs, you know, the visual storytelling, the coloring, you know, the covers. I mean, it's like you know, Pi's done it all, so it does have this kind of nice feel. Like most books, I think, feel like, quite rightly, because they're very much a team effort by a bunch of different people. And this is just me and Pi, and Pi is doing a huge amount of the. I think that one of the reasons it feels so fully formed is because of that. And another thing is, like, talking about the origins of the book. You know, Pi was doing these sort of posters of futuristic robots, very bright colors. They seem quite like thumbs up, kind of, hey, you know what I mean? And the tone that Pi, before I even came on board and said to Pi, like, well, you know, we thought about doing a comic with these, and then we started building a story together. The tone is kind of Pi's tone. And I think what Petrolhead is kind of like effectively the tone of those posters Pi was doing.
Yeah, I think you've quite effectively given me something I'm good at to do, which doesn't make the job a lot easier. Like, I haven't got to sort of do anything that's particularly out of my wheelhouse, so it's like it couldn't be more tailor-made, which is, you know, it does help with that, because that's the kind of thing I like to draw anyway.
Yeah, and so I think sort of hopefully a joy comes through it. But I do think as well, we wanted it to be very up. We talked about this at the start, like, and I think Pi did like some promo image of just like Petrolhead running and just like him kind of going go, and you know, it's an up book, and a lot of the reason for that, I think, is because of Pi. And then I've just brought my stuff to it as well. But that template was there from the start.
You know, and one of the things in Pi's work that really, you know, we've touched on briefly, but haven't really gotten a full deep dive in is just how well your colors bring this otherwise grim and dreary setting to life, in a way that, you know, this story could be a lot more grim visually than it is, and it's not. And I think that's a very intentional choice that you had to have made. And it pays out so well from the covers to the moment you open the interiors of the comic. That was one of the things that really stood out to me after I had been following you on social media and I saw some of the initial first reviews come through. I was like, you know what, I need to check this out, because these interiors alone look amazing. So even if I don't like cars that much, surely I can at least love the art. And damn, I couldn't be happier that I let that part of me that was like reluctant go, because in my mind I was like, if it's putting a car big on the front, then that means it's a car heavy story in a way that I need to care about cars and racing. And that's just not what this book is. It is a story filled with bots and riddled with humanity. And I think that a lot of it really does come down to, like you're saying, Pi's artwork here. And those colors especially.
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's interesting you say about the car, because that was a bit of a worry. Like, I quite like cars and stuff, but it's not like I spend a lot of time reading car comics, because they're not particularly interesting. But it's like, how do you show that on the cover? Like, this has cars in it, but there are more things, which is why we deliberately, you know, one of the four covers we did, only one of the four we did to start with had a car on it, because I just didn't want to, I didn't want to put people off. It's about more than that. And a lot of the racing sequences, they're not really about the race. They're always about something else.
Oh, yeah. It toes the line perfectly because, you know, I think that the perception that I had was this is going to be like a Father's Day weekend movie release. This is Ford versus Ferrari. This is you know, all those kinds of movies and stories like that. So, and one of the things that kind of it in that first cover, them of course I click on it and it goes away. The car in midair and Petrolhead's got his thumbs up and Dave's flying over him. There's still a lot more character to it than I gave it credit initially. Because again, I'm just so devoid of interest in cars that I really did let that be a gauge. And I've done everything I can in my post to instill that truth that people that this is so much more than anything that has to do with the damn cars. Because I mean, yeah, you get through that race, like you said, and there's purpose to those flashbacks. They're not just saying, oh yeah, here's some much needed action to liven the story up. No, yeah, there's yeah, some brilliant action in it, don't get me wrong. And some Pi, you know, we talked about your emotions, but your damn action sequences, I was gasping, and I don't even have the joy of reading it in the full spread of it in a physical form because I was reading it on my tablet. But those shots of cars wrecking into each other in the first issue alone, I mean, you got some powerful action shots that, you know, never feel like they're thrown in carelessly. They're there with a purpose because, like you said, there's more driving this story, no pun intended, I suppose. And even when it comes down to the, like I've said, with the satire on these cars and their mere existence is both like painfully hilarious, essentially. And then you look at, you know, I finally got to a page where I'm looking at the O, and maybe we talk more about this overarching AI threat that's looming, which is not like any of the AI threats that I think I've ever encountered in any form of, you know, AI storytelling that I've seen in regards to, you know, be it Skynet going rogue for Terminator or, you know, anything you can think of. I think that the role that the O plays in this is very interesting. If you want to talk about that some.
Well, I think he's sort of, rather than being out and out evil, he's more of like a personification of bureaucracy, which is just sort of infuriating to deal with. That would be my.
Yeah, he's kind of, he's doing what he's not a bad guy. He is our bad guy, but he's doing what he's programmed to do. And what he's programmed to do is protect the population. When you see his kind of origin sequence effectively in issue four, effectively, but this entire, everything that happens is down to that first panel where you see a guy just tighten his bolt a little too tight. I think that's why he is how he is. It's like, so he's been told you have to protect all the humans in the dome, and he just takes that a bit too far. So as a result, the thought of letting Linton's invention, which might potentially save humanity and you know, put the climate crisis back to right, he won't allow that because it's too risky. That would be taking the kind of the invention out basically and opening the dome in some form, and that's deadly. So I think, you know, he's just been programmed to be a bit overzealous. But again, I mean, I think, you know, his design is fantastic, and we talked about you know, he's got to have a huge brain to kind of be in charge of everything, to be running everything. So his head is like almost like three brains bolted together. But then Pi gave him like all these eyes, so he feels like he's looking in 400 different directions at the same time. And he's really creepy as a result. character we like a lot. And just again, Pop, every time he's on the page, it's just like he's a bit... it's a bit scary.
you added so many layers to this character just in that whole thing you just said that you kind of blown my mind here. You know, looking at it as he genuinely has this concern, more or less, that he would be out of a job, much like the petrol heads, were this device to work and allow humanity to go outside the domes, while simultaneously just taking it way too seriously that he has to protect them from inside the domes. And it really does add that depth, because, you know, in my reading, I really was like, this guy, because I humanized him more than I think I should have, considering that, you know, he is a bot that is screwed together a little too tightly, like you said. But he isn't inherently bad. You're right. And I don't know that I didn't read that, but there's so many more layers that I hadn't looked at to his role in this story as being his programmed role rather than maybe like AI gone rogue.
Yeah, he's kind of, I mean, his origin, you know, he kills effectively the prisoner he's put in charge of in his flashback sequence, his origin story we see in issue 4.
Oh, yeah.
But he doesn't do that because he's evil. He does it because
just takes his instructions far too literally.
Yeah, the guy tells him, I can't take this anymore. I just can't. Please let me out. I can't take it. The guy goes, right. And the O basically goes, okay, this guy's... I forget the line, but the instructions that the robots are given in that test sequence is very specific. It's like, it's up to you to reduce their unhappiness, I think it says. Something like that, basically. To the optimum.
Yeah.
So this guy is really... So he's put in charge of his prisoner, who is inside of a hermetically sealed dome, I will say, outside the city. And he's told you've got to look after this prisoner and reduce his unhappiness. And so the guy goes, basically tells the O, I am really, really, really unhappy in this dome. Will you let me out, please? And so the O goes, okay. And then that's why there's a, you know, amazing splash page where the scientist in charge says, who opened that dome? And then all the other robots all point at him. Like it was him. He, like, because it's a schoolyard. They're like robots in a classroom at that point. And he just goes, what did I do?
There's an interesting line in that just before that, though, which I quite liked, is it says something like, already, as it, like, so the alarm's gone off already. Someone's already died. Like, they were expecting this to happen. there's a sort of underlying evil to that situation.
There's a bit of, yeah, that's dark humor in that sequence. But I mean, Pi and I do come from 2000 AD, and that sequence in particular does feel very 2000.
Well, even the cover for issue 4 with the up close shot of the O just saying, I see you, is like, what I think gave me some of the most menacing vibes from him of them all, was really that cover that I'm just staring at it now. I'm like, you creepy bastard.
Yeah, and he is. He very much is. Yeah, he's terrifying to be around. But he doesn't know he's doing anything wrong. Like we said, Hybrid is programmed to be narcissistic. He's programmed to be overly officious and protect everyone. But that, you know, he does that a bit too much sort of energy. Put it that way.
Yeah, and Pi, your art it's so intricate in that way, like speaking over the art. I think it's something that's really cool and awesome about like all the vehicle characters. They're all very like intricate and all like the settings, but like it seems to be most prominently shown with the eye when you can see all like the details of all the bits of his like design and I don't even know what you'd call that, like the technology and the cables of it it is just like mesmerizing to look at.
Oh, thank you. The one thing I would say, like, I kind of make it up as I go along, that kind of stuff. So if you look, I try and maintain some sort of continuity between panels. But when it comes to drawing all those points, you just can't be bothered. So I just end up making them up. But then I quite like that ends up. Imagine if it was animated, you'd see them all the pipes all kind of writhing while he moved around, which would be even more horrible to look at.
Yeah.
I don't think I needed the image of it writhing around. So if you can unsee that for a second, I'm going to close my tablet so cover 4 is not looking at me anymore.
Well, that's another thing. Is like with him having a cloak covering his innards, that makes him a lot easier to draw, because there's a lot of things that Pye does in this book, like the engine of the chief Petrelhead's ride. Where, you know, it's one thing to draw all those engine parts in a one-off cover, but having to put them in every panel.
So no, I remember when we did sort of the panel in the end of the first part when it all bursts out and it looks super cool because you see all the bits. And he's like, "Are you sure about this? That's going to be quite a lot of work." I was like, "No, it'd be great." And then, you know, get to issue three and I'm like cursing myself for having to do the same cables coming off the...
Heard similar things about giving characters tattoos in books, and so I can't even fathom what it's like giving metal scraps and cables and all that to work with, and gears and whatnot, trying to incorporate them and keep that even remotely consistent. So I do think it's cool that you said with the O, you kind of get that freedom of be like, look, I'm just going to draw these squiggly cords and cables however the hell I want. And it does now. I'm never going to read this book again without seeing him writhing through those cords.
When you first meet him, he's attached to the ceiling by cables and then he's like stuck in the floor by him as well, but then he has to go out in the world, and we haven't really established how that works because the Diddery is attached to the floor earlier, but just kind of fudge it a little bit. I imagine to look a little bit who's the guy in the Dunwich Horror, the guy, is it Wilbur Whately? Have you ever read the H.P. Lovecraft book? He's like a sort of a man, he's a man down to the waist and then a writhing mass of tentacles under a skirt. I quite like that as an idea.
I can see it. Yeah. How you have him in that cloak really does. See, I didn't even think about him, now that you mentioned it, being like stationary in that first time we see him to where he was then like in a mobile form.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it is what it is. That's what the second volume's for, to dive into
the... No, that's true. You draw this stuff and then all of a sudden have to make it move, and that's when it becomes difficult. And again, going back to the drawing the technology, I mean, if you look closely, like, a lot of the stuff evolves as I've had to draw it in different positions and stuff I didn't imagine. All of a sudden the shapes I've used don't quite work. So Petrelhead's arms in particular change, sort of evolve throughout the book into a shape that actually is able to move in a way that I want it to, because they are made of metal, not of flesh. So things like crossing your arms for a robot becomes very difficult because all of a sudden all your bits start bashing into each other. It's interesting. And like, yeah, Dave changes throughout as well. Like, he starts off looking much more organically bird-like before becoming a bit more of a cartoon with a very round head. It's not quite thought out, as you might imagine.
people to worry about when the animated film is being made.
How exactly does this work? I don't know.
And like that almost nicely lends into what I was thinking about, is the idea of, we've talked a lot about like the energy of the comic and how it's very thrilling, etc. And like the appeal of cars, like, in the comic particularly, because it's one of those things when I was reading one of the issues a few months ago, I'm just like casually mentioning to my parents, like, "Oh, I'm reading a car chase in this comic issue," and they're like, "You're reading a car chase as a comic?" And then I sort of stopped for a moment and thought, I was like, "Oh yeah, that's really cool," and so it makes me appreciate it even more, because obviously, like in an animated format, it is moving, but when it's like a static sequential format, it can be maybe like, as comic readers, easy to take for granted that this is like a full-on, like, ongoing epic, like fast-paced kinetic scene, but within like in sequential panels, which I'm always curious how you sort of like feel about like how you pull that off in on the different sequences, because it's not something that I've seen very often. Like, I can't say I've seen many car chases in my comic books I've read.
Yeah, no, I remember. I'm sure it was like Gordon Rennie, like a 2000E writer, wrote a thing about, you know, he had like five things that he didn't think worked in comics, and one of them was car chases. And I was at the time was drawing a car chase for another comic I was doing, thinking, all right. So I quite like that as a challenge, really, trying to make it work. And as you say, the thing that's interesting about that is that in a film or an animation, the thing that makes a car chase exciting is the movement and the noise, neither of which you've got in a comic.
But we have, I mean, we go big on, don't we, on sort of like sound effects on the page and sort of, you know, to try and, try and do the best we can with that.
I think much like portraying body language in a robot. If with a car, it's all about the way it's rolling around to show you which direction it's going. It's the same technique, really. If something's sad, it slumps. If something's going fast, it's leaning back. If it's slowed, you know, I quite enjoyed sort of giving things that weight.
I think we totally pulled it off. And one thing from a writer's point of view is it takes up a lot of real estate because all those little incremental sort of movements, the changes in movement that you have on a film, let's say, of a great car chase, you know, one person pulling ahead, one person coming back at them, you know, the tires screeching and everything. You can easily eat up a bunch of pages in a comic very, very quickly doing that stuff. But I think, you know, again, it's all about character at the end of the day. Is like, you know, I think sort of the way in issue one, for instance, that big sort of the flashback to the heyday of a Petrolheads, the big race, you know, Pye's just done a stunning job on that. You do feel the impacts of the cars and whatever. But also, going against what Gordon said, I'd put two great examples of car chases in comics that do work. One is Jean-Paul Leon in The Wintermen, who effectively did a French Connection car chase, which is one of the best.
I feel like I've got a Wintermen comic, but is there more than one?
Yeah, there was a mini series. Yeah, and
I've got the one that's like. Sorry, we're going off a slight tangent here. I can't remember the name of the art. I bought it on the strength of the art, but I don't think it was Jean-Paul Leon who did it.
Oh no! There was an initial mini-series when it was all drawn by Jean-Paul Leon. I don't know if they did more.
Okay.
But that one, and also Alex Toth's Hot Wheels comics, which is crazy because it's a licensed toy comic, but Alex Toth never drew anything, which isn't an absolute genius triumph on the page. And he did that with car chases and things. So, it can be done. You've just got to be as good as Jean-Paul Leon, Alex Toth, or Piper. There you go.
Fuck off. I can't take that seriously. it's very. They've all said some very nice things about my art, but I can't do that.
I don't know. You made me someone who was, like I said, passing on this initially for the cars. Really care about some of those scenes where I'm like, oh shit, someone's about to wreck here. There's a lot to care about in those scenes, even from a perspective of genuinely having a disdain for that kind of media. Like, I don't like racing movies of any sort except for Talladega Nights. So, you know, to woe me the way that you did, you got to take some credit for that because I can't imagine how people who love cars and stuff like this had to have been impacted by it as well.
Oh yeah, well, it'd be nice to please both groups of people, wouldn't it? But I mean, again, I mean, thank you. But a lot of the reason why the car sequences are so good is because of the writing. It's not to do. You know, I've got the car sliding around, but the reason why you give a shit about it is because what Rob has done to make you care about the things and the themes that are involved in those races, and that's nothing to do with me.
Y'all are both too modest. It's compliment each other and push compliments away.
No, actually, I've had an epiphany and I've realized in this conversation that I am a genius. Oh my
God. Who needs ego death?
Oh no, I'm more like hybrid than I realized. I'm an athlete.
The self-insert character. Were you wearing an apron whenever you're like, hey, Pi,
you'll have to buy the trade to find that out, where we have apron wearing revealing photographs of ourselves.
When we were like looking at designing all the merch and stuff the other day, we've discovered that the people who do the print on demand merch, they do aprons. So I did wonder about doing a Kiss the Cook hybrid apron. That's an extremely niche item that no one's going to buy.
Oh yeah, we do. We should say we have T-shirts and mugs and all sorts on the website now.
Yeah, so, plug away whatever you guys want.
They are surprisingly awesome, actually. So I think we were both genuinely pleased when we got our little sample T-shirt through and went, oh, I would actually wear these.
yeah, it's always a bit worrying when you don't really know what people are going to get. And the quality was quite nice. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool because I didn't really have I'd obviously seen the Instagram, but I hadn't spent too much time looking at the website. So it's quite cool what other people are chatting and just like have a look and see some of the options there, and like you got like the t-shirts and like the badges, which is cool. to the badge set, if that's your thing.
Yeah. What else is on there? Mugs. Yeah, we have a mug.
Yeah.
Potentially, we have an apron.
I'm not spending the time doing the apron. I can't be bothered.
But it's all fun, but it's also from a practical point of view. When you make the decision to go down the image route and you own it yourselves in its entirety, you know, you've got to try and make it work financially in any way you can. So if we can sell a few tokens here and there, and then great. It hopefully helps pay for us to do Petrolhead, series 2.
I'm seeing there's some awesome prints on here too of the covers. Yeah, I hadn't been to your website yet. That's very fun.
And I got all the different issues and things that are on there to buy.
I need to get me a Sid pin, Sid and Dave pin immediately. Absolutely. Now you all got me distracted looking at your designs. Hell yeah.
There you go. And we did a, we've got a friend of Pi's, I think it's a friend, but anyway, put together an amazing animated trailer for us as well, which is on the website if people want to go and take a look.
Hell yeah.
And get a feeling for what it might look like if it makes it to being a film.
Huh. Oh, it's cool. Yeah. And it's another thing, an Instagram page and a website for the comic, it told me that there was more to it than just cars, and seeing just how much thought and care you've put into every element of bringing this story to life, it only makes me love the book that much more, and that's not a slight against people that don't put in all of this extra work. That's a lot of work that you guys are taking on, and to have Pi's wife hopping in and helping out with that, that's a lot of stuff you have going for this comic that I think really sets it apart from the rest of the books that are on stands right now.
Thanks to hear you.
So that's my favorite part of all these is getting to hear all those little details that, you look at a page, you read it, even read it twice before an interview, and I'll still miss something that, someone brings up in these interviews. And Joe and I haven't had a whole lot of times where we have both creators for a book on. So when we do, it's that much more fun. Like you said, you get the back and forth with each other and really having, you two lead the conversation as well, bouncing back and forth with the different things that, really mean a lot to you all about, what this story is. With the June 4th release date on the first trade, it's the classic image first trade, $9.99. It you'd be foolish not to pick it up. I can't imagine listening this far into this interview and not being pretty damn sold on this book by now.
Yeah, you get a lot of comic for $9.99. We've been talking about that this week. You get an awful lot of comic from $9.99. I understand why Image do it with the first trade, to try and entice in new readers. But I think you're getting some 120 interior pages, I think. It's good value for money.
It's a great value. And I know that Image has started to slowly pull away from that as certain books ended up being more like, maxi miniseries where it's, an 8-issue first volume or something like that, with some titles where it's like, they had to bump it to the $16.99 for those extended chunks, or the books that they're like, no, we're going to print all 10 issues in one go rather than doing them in chunks of 5. So I think it really helps to have that accessibility. And I think that's one of Image's strong suits, especially getting out those collected editions.
Yeah, it's funny. When they first asked what we want to do, we were both like, well, can we have, a massive oversized hardback with 50 pages of extras? And I'm like, well, yeah, you could do that, but maybe you'd want to sell a few of them.
Right. No, seriously.
Just go for a bit of a bare bones thing to start with. And I think,
from a shop perspective, that goes such a long way, guys.
Right.
It's hard enough, like you say, getting people to try a book whenever there's 20 titles on the wall for New Comic Book Day. But then you get a bookshelf and, you're working with a spine if it's not on the front-facing wall anymore. And whenever you are working with a spine, it helps to have that lower investment into the book, and that for both the shop and the reader, because – if it weren't for $9.99 books, two of my favorite books of all time, I would have never found them initially, because, I had 10 bucks to throw at Saga at one point, and I had 10 bucks to throw at Die at one point. Mm-hmm. So by the time it came on to later volumes hitting that $14.99 mark, I had put that initial investment in, and I was already so into the series that it didn't faze me that it goes up in the second volume, which is pretty.
That's one of the interesting thing I've found about sort of doing this, is because people don't have it when you first start something. Nobody's got any emotional investment in your comic, so you kind of have to do that just to make people care for later. And I hope people do end up giving giving a shit about it in the same way that they do other stuff, other characters.
On something I'm seeing on the website that I didn't even really consider, but I do love bringing up whenever I see it, is that this is an all ages book. Looking back, I was like, I wouldn't have a problem giving this to just about any comic reader. Anything that's even remotely suggestive, I think, would go over those people's heads. And I don't even think there is anything suggestive that I can recall. So seeing that on the website, that is something that I do find very important to point out, because there's a difference in some people think young adult and mature comics, but there's a fine line with that all ages section where this book is accessible to anyone, and I think that's another strong point you got going here. And that's something that stands out really good about the trade cover. We talked about the covers for the individual issues, but putting Lupa front and center on that trade with Petrol, you know, standing behind her with this protector sense, it takes way more up from that page than the car at the bottom of it. And I think that that really sticks true to what people are going to get when they open up this story, to see that, look, yes, there's a cool-ass car in it. There's going to be some cool car races, but I mean, even from that first page I talked about earlier with the Petrol and that rose outside of Chief's memorial, it's immediately full of love. And even through the bickering and the antagonistic nature that we talked about with Lupa and Petrolhead, there's care in every panel of this book. And I'm so excited to see where it goes from here.
Well, thanks, man.
Yeah, really, me too. Cool. I've not read anything, you know, it's not written yet, so I'm quite excited to see it too.
Yeah, we got plans. I mean, yeah, like I say, there'll be a break, and because we can't, you know, we're probably doing everything. You know, it's simply not possible to carry on doing it on a monthly schedule. But I think, you know, the plan is we'll be back with a second mini series, and hopefully we'll just continue it in the Hellboy kind of model, really. You know, all being well, we'll get a new mini series every now and again and a new trade, and that'll continue the story. Because, like we said at the start, there's seven dome. The moment you write a line like the Ozone, one of the seven remaining human cities, you go, oh, well, there's immediately a lot more story you can tell, because what's happening in those other cities, and whether we'll ever get to that, we shall see. But it's kind of interesting how you start world building, and it does just that. It just ends up sort of possibilities keep on opening up. So yeah, we'll see. I think we'd both love to do a lot more of it, but you know, it's going to depend on finances.
Yeah, no, that's right. I can't think of anything I've enjoyed so far in my career as much as this, really. So I am desperate to do more, but it's got to work financially. So we'll do some more this year.
Very excited to hear that. And you know, I need to explore some of your all's other work, because this was my first time coming across either of your names, and I couldn't have been more blown away by a first impression of a creative team, genuinely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. No, well, I can't speak for Rob, but this goes back to a point you were saying earlier about it being all ages. Like the only other thing I did was a horror comic, and that was work for hire. So it's not really, I'm not invested in it in the same way, but I was proud of the work I did on it, but I don't give a shit about it in the same way that I do Petrolhead. And one of the things I found difficult was when I sat there with a few comics on a table trying to sell it, and then a parent would come past with a kid and say, oh, just have a flick through this. And I went, nope, don't look in that. And I found it kind of embarrassing, really. I'd much prefer to talk to kids and say, yeah, get excited about it in the same way that I am.
No, totally. And that goes through to the comic shop. You know, that really, really does shine through whenever, you know, we got X amount of comics. And I was just writing an article before this interview talking about just how dwindling comics are when it comes to an all ages comic, where it can walk the line between young adult and, you know, anyone else reading it. And, you know, that can be a fine line, but I think you guys really, really pull it off in that. I don't think at any point this is too juvenile, for like lack of better word, nor do I think it's too heady for like a younger reader to get behind. I think that, like you mentioned, the Hot Wheels comics, stuff like that, you know, kids come into a comic shop and they see that, and it might be an IP about toy cars, but that gets them excited. And then they look over and they see Petrolhead the next time they're in the shop, and they're like, hey, I don't know what this is, but maybe I can look at it. You know, they see that, and you know, that's where that car works really well, because there is a huge audience for this book. There's a huge audience, and it's even wider than the cover of that first issue would portray. which is, you know, getting that all ages stamp, it really goes a long way, not having to, you know, shoo kids away from the comic book wall and be like, oh yeah, or like letting a mom know you might want to grab that from your kid. That's like the last comic you want them touching on the wall. It takes a load off of from the retailer side, and it also it just makes the comic that much more marketable. It really does. You know, there's people that if you told them it was all ages, they might freak out and be like, I don't want to check that out. What does that mean? But not the same way they freak out if they saw, oh, this is young adult friendly.
No, that's right. It's not like a kid's version of a grown-up property. It's its own exactly. thing, and I think that's a strength. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it works great. I think it's the perfect mix of it all. And I'm really eager for the trade to come out. I hope that people that missed it in issues get to pick this up and end up loving it as much as we did.
Yeah, I mean, it was always the intention going in was to make it accessible. You know, I've written, you know, Vertigo type books. People have written for Vertigo in the past where you get perhaps more dense comics. But it was really, you know, bright colors, accessible. We call back like Pixar movie on the page. You know, that's what we were trying to achieve here. So, yeah, it's nice to hear that seems to.
Well, fellas,
I think
that's probably a good spot to wrap it up.
Unless Joe wants to say what he's going to
say. Yeah, I was going to say Joe. I started saying that, and it was horrible timing as usual.
No, it's fine. I was just thinking it might be a good point, a good way to wrap it up by finishing off, because I'm curious. I think I've heard you mention like once or time before or on other things about the idea of obviously like you being like here in England and having that work on 2000 AD and sort of exposing your work to the American comics market more with like through Image, with Petrolhead, because I know that maybe Rob, you've maybe done quite a lot of various things in American comics, but I don't think Pine Hat is obviously correct me, so if I'm wrong. It's just interesting. Yeah, it's just interesting. Both like for you, like taking something that is wholly your own, as you've mentioned, and just making such a wild go of it here, but also as someone equally that hasn't really come across your name on American comics and hasn't ever delved into 2000 AD myself, despite being like here in England and always feeling like I want to at some point. But
well, it's kind of, I always find it like there's some amazing work has always been done in 2000 AD, to going back to when it started in 77, and that continues, you know. But it is interesting, but just like the American market just largely just is unaware of like some of the stuff that's going on there. So you can have an entire career and no one in America is kind of too aware of it. So it is quite nice when you have, like, I've been working in comics for a few years now. So when Petrolhead came out, some of the reaction was like, yeah, who's this guy? Where's he been?
Yeah.
Well, you know, but similarly, you know, it's exactly the same with the European market. You know, it's just unbelievable creators in the European market. Just, we're totally unaware for the most part in the UK and in America of what they're doing. But that was a nice thing with like sort of, you know, I was almost like a secret weapon on this, I guess.
Right, yeah.
But I'm not going to lie, I did sort of try quite hard because I was very aware that like, right, I need to show off now to sort of prove yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah,
really coming out the gate swinging for all this. People hopefully get introduced to your work through this, including me and Mighty.
Yeah, I'll definitely be keeping my eye out for both your all's names moving forward. This book, like I said, fantastic introduction for me to both of y'all, and I couldn't be happier that we got this chance to talk to y'all. It was really funny. I think Joe and I kind of hit the revelation at the same time when talking that who do we want to have on coming up? And we both kind of were like, well, why didn't we think to ask the Petrolhead fellas on? That kind of seems like a no-brainer with how much both of us have been so avidly just in love with it. So, you know, getting the response back from y'all and getting to set this up was a real delight.
No, we really appreciate the kind words and everything and just how enthusiastic you've been, like Pai said. So, yeah, thanks a lot, guys. And, hopefully we can talk to you again in the future, maybe when we do the second trailer.
We'd be happy to have you back.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. Yeah, and I sort of wanted to mention, I don't know how much this will be useful to international listeners, by which I mean like people out, like in America or Europe, but I didn't want to mention that, of course, you are, as we mentioned earlier, you are selling like the single issues and things on your site. Then there's also the, you can pre-order the trade and directly from them on their site, obviously. Try and support the good comic book stores if you can, but if you want, you can pre-order a signed copy of the trade from their site, which I have done. With this coming up, I was reminded, it's like, oh yeah, I better do that. So 10 quid plus delivery. So, and I noticed recently you posted on social media about how on Forbidden Planet, the website, here it's quite cheap on there as well. So,
you don't want to buy
yeah.
that when you get 7 quid. I mean,
yeah, I know. Yeah, well, no, if I get it from you, I can get it signed.
Absolutely. And there's, we've done a few things with the trade coming out. OK Comics, which is a brilliant comic shop.
Yes,
there's an exclusive print there that's signed, which is you'd only get from them. And I think
Forbidden Planet comes with a print as well, doesn't it? Although they haven't actually mentioned that on there.
Yeah, and the Big Bang, which is a great comic shop in Dublin as well. They're going to have an exclusive print as well. So, people need to collect them all.
That's very good. It's always nice to have bonuses like that. I remember being at the shop and having the folks sit in, like, signed book plates and stuff. So that's just one more thing you got going towards it.
Well, if you want some for your shop, let me know. I'll sort some
out. I will keep you posted, but I don't expect you to send something all the way over here to Colorado.
Well, I don't care. It's all right. Oh, I can just send you a file. You print it yourself.
That's fair. I don't have a printer, but either way, we can figure something out.
Just let me know. If you want something, I'll do it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I appreciate that.
Oh, look, thanks a lot, guys. And also, I don't know if anybody's going to be at Thought Bubble Convention in November, but Pi and I will have a table there, and we'll have lots of merchandise and comics and Petrolhead stuff to sell. So, yes.
And the London Comic Con as well.
Oh, London Film and Comic Con are going to be at as well in July. That's great.
Very cool.
Yeah, I was going to say beforehand, I was thinking beforehand, because I was at Thought Bubble last year and it was my first one, but I hadn't yet read the comic, so I didn't come and meet you. But I feel like if I go again this year, then I'll have to come and probably meet you in person. But yeah, Thought Bubble was awesome. My one experience so far.
You've not done many conventions then?
No, Thought Bubble was my first one last year. So,
oh, wow.
Both first convention and first Thought Bubble. So that was exciting.
Yeah, start with the big one. It's, yes. Yeah. It turned into a monster, right? It's huge now. Yes. But yes, no, brilliant. Well, do come and say hello.
Well, and also bearing in mind that I'm sort of like down towards the south of England, so travelling all the way up to Yorkshire, it wasn't too bad, actually, but... I've never really been up north of England, so it was doubly exciting.
Yes. It's a great convention, and if people haven't been, they should go. It's a very uncynical just celebration of comics in all its forms, which is terrific.
I wish we had something like that in the States, because all we have is fan expos now. Everything is like half just fandom in general that has nothing to do with comics, so they just like dropped Comic-Cons to just like fan expos all over the place, and it's like plushes galore and prints for days, and then like 3 to 5 people selling actual comics that aren't the actual artists themselves. So
yeah, I think that's one of the strengths of Thought Bubble, really, is they really celebrate the art of it. So there's a lot of people just doing like, very small, like absolutely beautiful things. And you just think, like, oh my God, that must have cost you absolutely tons to make all this stuff. And love it. Yeah,
well, especially when like San Diego Comic Con is like the one that I remember was one of the first and most prominent ones that I heard about. It's like the convention. In terms of like such a juggernaut that it has become. So when like I first heard about Thought Bubble a few years ago, and it was something that was much, much more accessible, I was like, oh, and then sort of realizing, as you say, it's sort of very wholesome and uncynical, and the tickets themselves even were much cheaper than I thought. That the more expensive part was everything else. So, and it just
you go to somewhere like San Diego, or sorry to interrupt, the New York Comic Con, and you know, they do have the artist alley where all, you know, all your favorite creators will be. But they're usually like in New York Comic Con downstairs, the actual con floor is this huge thing, which is just traders, people, a lot of people selling tat as like plushies and all kinds of nonsense. And a lot of computer game, huge computer game stalls and things. And it's like, so yes, even that is, it's, you have to almost fight to find the comics in a comic event.
Yeah, the budget's just so wildly different. You can't compete, can you, really, with that sort of marketing budget level stuff?
Yeah,
exactly. Especially because those folks will just, I mean, they're tradesmen. They go out on the road with those plushes and they go from town to town pretty much nonstop. It's wild to talk to those folks at conventions whenever we've been there with the shops and just see, like, you know, there's those tables at smaller conventions where, you know, they come and you know that you'll see them at the big fan expo this summer, but they're also here at the one this weekend that I'd be at if I wasn't here right now, actually. And, you know, they won't sell anything the whole time. You're like, well, how do you do this? Like, well, because my other shows pay for it. And so it's become a different crowd than what, I grew up with, the Small Planet Comic Con in Kansas City, and even seeing what that's grown into from being this, like, hotel conference room full of comics as far as the eye can see and these legendary creators stopping in to, like I said, more of a pop culture convention than anything.
Yeah. It's weird, which, again, like, Thought Bubble is it's not none of that at all. It's just
landed it right when you said that it's not cynical. Like, as soon as you said that, I was like, yep, nope, that's exactly what it feels like going to any of the conventions I've been to. And it's a shame because, like, I see all the posts from Thought Bubble and all the creators going there. And I'm like, that's what I want to see in a convention. So that'd be a dream to make it across the way. Yeah.
You should. I mean, and like last year, we had people coming up to the table. Do you mind if I show you my work? Who would like young people just starting out? And some of the quality of the people, you know, you can feel like this is where the new blood flow of comics is coming. You know, and it feels, you come away feeling comics is a very healthy place. I mean, you go home and you see your royalty sales for your comic and your enthusiasm is going, okay, let's go back to Thought Bubble.
Yeah, back to reality.
Thought Bubble. We love Thought Bubble. Look, it's been lovely talking. I'm afraid I'm gonna have to run, but I've got my family here. I'm currently at my in-laws' house and I've taken up too much of their time, but again, look, really want to say thank you very much again for your enthusiasm towards the book. It's appreciated.
Our pleasure.
No, it's thank you.
Yeah, cheers.
Have a nice rest of your day.
Yeah, all right, cheers, guys, take it easy. Bye.